Welcome to WISO's weekly radio magazine, WISO Weekend. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for being here. Coming up in the next half hour, we'll explore the art and psychology behind tattooing on Culture Couch. You'll also hear all about the second annual Makers Fair taking place at Carillon Park next weekend. We've got commentary from Bob Brekka and Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. All that and more coming up. Up first, this summer, WISO is bringing you stories of Ohioans living with disabilities. Today in our series, Just Ask, we explore the topic of caregiving. Many people with disabilities in the Miami Valley rely on aides to help with day-to-day tasks. In this story, from WISO's April Leslie, Michaela Fieser from Dayton explains what it feels like to clash with an aide you depend on every day.
Michaela has cerebral palsy, a neurological disorder that can affect body movement and coordination. She's got bright brown eyes and dark brown hair that's usually tied up in a ponytail. She uses a wheelchair and has problems using her hands.
This hand works very well. This hand just sits there. But this hand, though, let me tell you, I can arm wrestle my sister with my clothes. I am that strong.
Michaela's disability has meant that throughout her life, she's had to rely on aides or daily caregivers for help sometimes. In school, she had aides that would help her with everything from getting to class on time to using the restroom. Because the relationship was so intimate by nature, Michaela says it was a huge problem when she didn't click with an aide.
I would have aides following me everywhere. Everywhere that I went, aides would follow me everywhere. Like, even if I was going in the hall to talk to my friends, she would be there. Every time I turned around, she would be there. Like, it was, like, so hard to, like, live. To live in a shadow.
An aide's personality could shape Michaela's daily life at school. She became good friends with one of her high school aides, even exchanging gifts during the holidays.
She would understand me. I would have her go get my lunch. I would tell her what I want to eat. She would go get it for me. Like, her favorite thing was Salisbury steak and mashed potatoes. And, like, that year was very easy for me.
But if an aide wasn't having a good day, neither was Michaela. She remembers one aide who always seemed to be in a bad mood.
She would not even look at me, even speak to me. I would say, good morning. Good morning. And she would just, not a word.
She says that kind of interaction made her feel invisible, a feeling she was already familiar with from some of the other kids at school.
I would have, like, students, I mean, people up against lockers talking about me like I wasn't in the room, but clearly I was. But I would, like, say, hey, I'm right here. I can hear what you all are saying. I can hear fine. You want to give me a test and see if I can hear you correctly? Because I can.
Things finally changed for the better when Michaela graduated from high school.
I felt really good about graduating. Like, that pain and that suffering that I had went to through all those years, we're finally gone, and finally I could take a calming breath of relief, knowing that that weight lifted off my shoulders.
Now, Michaela's part of a program which teaches people with disabilities job, independent living, and computer skills.
Like, you know, how to learn how to type. I can type 50 words a minute, 5 words a minute. And I would be like, just typing up a storm.
She's hoping the skill she's learning will help her find a job she likes. She's still figuring out what she'd like to do as a career. In the meantime, Michaela dreams of building her own family one day.
My plan for the future is to hopefully have a job, have kids running around, have a big house, and having a person that I could trust for as long as I can trust. And so, for me, I think being married, having kids, and that is my dream. That is my dream. That will always be my dream. And that will be my dream for the rest of my future. That is all that I want.
Michaela is 24 now. She lives with her family in Dayton. We were introduced to her by the Montgomery County Board of Developmental Disabilities Services. She participates in a program there to advocate for people with disabilities. For WYSO, I'm April Leslie.
To learn more about our series, Just Ask, talking about disability and the organizations that helped make it possible, go to our website, wyso.org. Tattoos have become a major part of our culture. With over 20,000 tattoo parlors in the U.S. alone, tattooing has become a billion-dollar industry. But it's the stories behind the ink that interested Community Voices producer George Drake Jr., and he went to Dayton to learn more about some of them.
If someone gets a tattoo, chances are there's a story.
It's basically a combination of the Grateful Dead dancing bears, but they're turned into Star Wars figures.
By the end of the session, Michael Grabman will have Yoda, Chewbacca, a stormtrooper, Boba Fett, and Darth Vader dancing around his left leg. He's a self-proclaimed deadhead and Star Wars enthusiast.
And I found this thing where it's like a perfect combination of the two. And I'm like, you know, this is something I really want.
Every tattoo that I have has some sort of connection or meaning. For the most part, I don't have anything that's like a throwaway, silly thing.
This is Chad Wells. He's doing the tattoo. He's the owner of Wells & Company Custom Tattoos in Dayton's Fireblocks District and has hundreds of hours worth of tattoos on his own body.
I have a full back piece. I have both arms are heavily tattooed. My hands are tattooed. My neck's tattooed. My head under all this long hair is tattooed. Legs and calves and feet and everything has a tattoo on it.
When Chad was a kid, he used to draw on his hands and clothes. His tattoos are essentially an extension of that, a way to set himself apart from others.
When I was a kid, it was like a permanent middle finger to everybody and everything. My tattoos are really pretty positive, but like the fact that I have them says like, I'm going to do what I want and you have zero say in that.
However, sometimes a tattoo says too much, or maybe it doesn't mean what it used to, or it's a part of someone that they want to leave behind. So they get a new tattoo over the one they want to forget.
Yeah, cover-ups are, that's a big thing.
And not just ex-lovers' names or tattoos that people don't like anymore, but tattoos with gang affiliations or racist meanings. One customer of Chad's had spent time in prison, and during that time, he joined the Aryan Brotherhood and got a giant swastika tattooed on his chest.
That's a thing in the prison culture that we don't have to deal with that stuff out here. But I think that he may have had to make the choice to wear those colors, as we call it, in prison to survive.
But it was no longer a life he wanted to be a part of. So he had Chad cover it up.
And he was getting married that next weekend to a lovely young Jewish girl, which I thought was just wonderful. And she knew about the tattoo. She knew about his history. And there was nothing I could do. It was so solid black. There was nothing I could do other than just box it off. He has a giant black box on his chest now.
And some people with difficult pasts use tattoos to cover up painful memories.
It's comforting to see things that give you hope more so than scars.
That's Dawn Tarjeft. She's been a client of Chad's for over 10 years. Now, most often, tattoo artists use a computer-printed stencil to act as a guide for tattoos. But for one of her most personal ones, she let Chad draw it entirely by freehand before tattooing. It's on the right side of her face. She calls it her space flower.
I was in an abusive relationship for a short time, and the guy gave me a head injury. It was traumatic to see the scar every day. So I had Chad basically do like a 3-hour session, and that's where that piece comes from.
Dawn says she didn't know how much the tattoo had helped her until it was done, because after getting it, she says she had her first week of sleep following 3 years of constant sleepwalking and night terrors.
And another thing is, a lot of my tattoos are friend-oriented. I have friendship pieces with a ton of people. So it also represents people that I love. You know, it's like walking around with a photo book. Only much cooler.
Chad compares tattoos to an art collection. While they won't appreciate over time or become family heirlooms, they're more personal and, in a sense, priceless. Because when you go, they go.
It's purely yours. It purely exists in the moment that you're here. This tattoo is an always changing thing that's going to not be the same in 10 years as it is now. And when I die, it's gone. So there's like a built-in scarcity or rarity thing that I think is cool about tattoos.
Chad Wells is the owner of Wells & Company Custom Tattoos in Dayton. For Culture Couch on WYSO, I'm George Drake Jr.
I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WYSO Weekend on WYSO. Thanks for joining us. Today on WYSO Curious, we answer a question from listener Holly Cozy of Springfield. Holly wanted to know about the abandoned buildings along the bike path in Goes Station, just south of Yellow Springs. Community Voices producer Renee Wild has the explosive history behind the buildings and the town.
Tucked behind a row of weeds along the Little Miami Scenic Bike Trail, halfway between Xenia and Yellow Springs, there's a group of abandoned red brick buildings. These are the remains of the Miami Powder Company, a factory located in Ghost Station that made gunpowder during the late 1800s. To learn more about the history behind these buildings, I stopped by the Greene County Historical Society, where Executive Director Catherine Wilson graciously took time out from their annual yard sale to share photos and memorabilia with me from the Miami Powder Company.
Well, it started out in 1850s, somewhere in there, and it was Austin and King. And Mr. King bought out Mr. Austin, and then it became King's Powder Mill, and then it became Miami Powder Company.
King's Powder Mill then moved farther south, down the Little Miami River into Warren County, in what's now known as the town of King's Mills. Black gunpowder was widely used in firearms, fireworks, and as blasting powder for quarrying, mining, and road building. Now, there were a couple of reasons why gunpowder mills were located along the Little Miami.
Exactly, water power.
To run the steam-powered mills. Another reason were the abundance of willow trees growing along the banks of the river. The gunpowder was made up of saltpeter, soda ash, and charcoal. And by harvesting and burning the willows along the river, the powder mill was able to make a special grade of charcoal necessary for the explosives. A 1933 article in the Dayton Daily News by Howard Burba recounts that before the mills were established, the banks of the Little Miami River were lined with hundreds of thousands of black willow trees, some of which were hundreds of years old.
And the Goes Station part of it, it was Mr. Goes' property, William Goe, G-O-E, and it was a watering station for the railroad because they got river water, and they used it for the steam engines, so that was Goes Station.
The powder companies were the site of many explosions, and working in the powder mill was really hazardous. The employees were encouraged to work in their socked feet or in overshoes, because exposed nails in the workers' boots could cause sparks, which would result in an explosion.
People say, well, that's why it's named Goes, because there it goes again, because it blew up so often.
Newspaper articles from this time period describe the aftermath of these explosions in pretty gory detail.
There was one particular explosion that the biggest thing they found was the front leg of a donkey at Old Town. How about the one blast where three men were killed and the biggest piece they found of one man was part of his chest, and they only knew it was that one particular man because his chest was so hairy. There's a burial out at the Woodland Cemetery here in Xenia, and it's just 10 men killed, in powder explosion at Miami Powder Mills, and they couldn't identify them enough to bury them under their names.
The largest explosion was on March 1st, 1886, when shortly before 10 a.m., a boiler room exploded, setting off 30 tons of gunpowder. The explosion left a 15-foot hole in the ground, and three men working in the boiler room lost their lives that day. The concussion from the explosion caused the glass and windows and doors to explode 5 miles away in Xenia. 25 miles away in Lebanon, horses spooked and broke loose from their hitching post, and newspapers reported that 65 miles away, the ground in Columbus shook like an earthquake, and windows rattled in their frames.
It finally blew up for the last time around 1922.
In addition to newspaper clippings, the Historical Society has some really great photos of the powder company from a former superintendent.
This little concrete watering trough for the horses is still there in Goes. It's marked MP Company 1892, and it's still there.
The former Miami Powder Company buildings along the bike path and the surrounding land are now privately owned by a local farming family operation outside of Yellow Springs. On my way home, I thought about all the people and the animals that had lost their lives so violently at the powder company. And I'm pretty sure that that area has to be haunted. But a Google search didn't turn up one single ghost story for Goes Station or the Miami Powder Company. Even so, I wouldn't want to hang around there after dark. For Why So Curious, I'm Community Voices producer Renee Wild.
Why So Curious is sponsored by Proto Build Bar, proud supporter of Curious Minds. Let us know what you're curious about at our website, wyso.org. Well, next week is round two of Dayton History and Carillon Park's very successful Dayton Mini Maker Fair. Last year's inaugural event drew more than 2,500 people. The event is a two-day celebration of people who, you guessed it, know how to make stuff. Some 90 exhibitors will feature live demonstrations and hands-on learning activities in robotics, rocketry, 3D printing, and more. To talk about this year's Makers Fair, we spoke with Josh Corey of Make It Dayton, the group behind the Makers Fair, and Alex Heckman, Director of Operations at Dayton History. Corey starts by telling us more about the organization he founded.
Make It Dayton's just a group of makers here in Dayton. We get together to put on the Maker Fair and just really celebrate making and innovation here in Dayton.
Who gets involved in this?
Everybody. Anybody who's ever taken something apart and had six screws left over, this is a festival for you. You can come learn just a totally wide array of things. If you want to learn how to walk a catwalk, the Emergent Fashion Incubator will be here to teach you to do that. Want to build a rocket? You can do it out on the front lawn. And then, of course, we've got the Boneyard Build-Off. If you were a fan of the show Junkyard Wars, that's our spin on this. We run through Mendelssohn's, grab as much stuff as we can, and six teams are going to build a mystery project for a prize at the end of the festival.
So who are your kind of vendors? Who's going to be doing the demonstrating?
Well, obviously, there are vendors. So you'll be able to buy supplies so you can make things. Like MCM Electronics will be selling electronics kits. So you can learn to solder on site, pick up an electronics kit, do that. There's also just local groups that want to show off their hobby. Dayton is a big ham radio town, and the Dayton Amateur Radio Association is going to have a whole pavilion out here showing you how you can get involved and what all you can do with ham radio. Then there's things I had never even heard of before. We've got a group that actually builds historic warships that are radio controlled and then battled them. So if you ever want to see how old Ironsides would compare to, say, the Bismarck, they can make that happen.
How many attendees are going to show up?
We're hoping for about 5,000 that weekend.
Right. Alex, so Dayton has a history of innovation. Tell us a little bit more about how that ties in.
Sure. Yes, Dayton, Ohio is a city of invention and innovation. When you think about some of our most famous history stories, the Wright brothers working in their own bicycle shop, or you think about Charles F. Kettering and Edward Deeds and the Barn Gang working on nights and weekends to develop the electric automobile starter and the electric ignition system. It's that type of spirit of collaboration and creativity and making of things that has built Dayton, Ohio. We're now today, unfortunately, known as one of these Rust Belt cities, but there's so much more to that story. There are people working all across the greater Miami Valley region, building things, working in tooling and machining, working in high-end electronics, working in so many other different fields. And we try to bring all of that energy together to Carillon Historical Park, which is a campus devoted to telling this story over the past 200 years of people that have been making wine, making beer, people that have been making automobile starters or pop-top can ends or making airplanes or bicycles or sewing machines, all of these things that are just the basis of a city of 1,000 factories of a century ago or two centuries ago kind of comes together here with some critical mass at the park.
Josh, how can folks find out more about this or get involved?
If you want to find out more, you can go to the Maker Faire website. That's dayton.makerfaire.com. If you want to get involved, that's a good place to do it too. If you want to volunteer or talk about exhibiting for next year.
The Maker Faire runs August 5th and 6th, correct?
So the Maker Faire event will be taking place at Carillon Historical Park on August 5th and 6th. On Saturday, August 5th, it runs from 9:30 a.m. until 5 p.m., and then again on Sunday, August 6th, from 11 a.m. until 4 p.m. Regular park admission fees do apply, and it's also a wonderful time to purchase a Dayton History membership, which will allow entry to the event and to the campus for an entire year. We also have our popular scale train running on both days of Maker Faire. So if people have ever been to Carillon Park to ride the trains or here for our rail festival, we have a 7.5-inch gauge railroad, about a mile worth of railroad track. So there's something for everyone, whether you're a little child in a stroller or whether you're someone that's, you know, in your later years in life and anyone in between. We have something going on during Maker Faire that should appeal to you.
Great. And again, you can find those details at the website.
Dayton.makerfaire.com.
Alex and Josh, thanks so much.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is WISO Weekend on WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenney. Today, sustainability commentator Bob Brekka tackles a thorny question. How much energy does it take to make energy using wind turbines and solar panels?
Here's a scary thought. What if all the effort being put into new wind turbines and solar panels is a waste of time and money because they don't create as much energy as it takes to build and install them? And because of that, maybe they don't help reduce greenhouse gas emissions either. I get asked questions about this less often than I once did, but every once in a while, questions about the overall energy or environmental footprint of wind and solar technologies even show up in professional journals and from contributors to reasonable blogs. As a scientist who is always willing to question ideas, I want to take these things seriously. For me, tough questions like these are part of how science is done. We turn every question on its head and examine it from all perspectives, poking and probing at an issue to see how far we can push our conclusions and where our ideas and theories start to show cracks. That's science. Critical, well-posed questions are important for the advancement of science and technology. The statement that it takes more energy to manufacture a solar panel than it will ever generate is one that can be examined by analyzing data. It's not just a matter of opinion. Engineers use something called life cycle analysis to delve into questions like these. And it's not that easy to figure out. There's a long chain of inputs to making a solar panel. There's direct energy used in manufacturing, energy needed to transport panels to the installation site, and then you have to go all the way back to energy needed to build the factory and the machinery that mines the minerals that go into the photovoltaic cells. In fact, the best example of life cycle analysis is probably the old Mother Goose rhyme, "This is the house that Jack built." But the point is, procedures can be well-defined and codified so that engineers and scientists anywhere can reproduce results or make modifications. The results are reported and checked, and the data are made available to others if needed. Science is an open process, and that characteristic is fundamental to not only its success, but also to the trust in scientists that citizens have typically had. So now I've been holding you in suspense because I haven't answered the question I started with. Do solar panels and wind turbines pay off in terms of the energy produced compared to the input energy for manufacturing? Not surprisingly, as time goes on, manufacturing gets more efficient. Currently, the energy cost of a solar panel is such that it takes about a year or so of operation to break even, maybe a little longer in places with less sun. And even considering the whole life cycle of processes, the overall greenhouse gas emissions for solar photovoltaic electricity are about 95% less than from natural gas, a good deal for energy use and for the climate. We can look at wind turbines or any other technology in the same way. Over its lifetime, the greenhouse gas emissions from a wind turbine are even lower than for solar photovoltaic electricity, and it takes less than a year to gain back the energy used to make and install the turbine. That means the return on your energy investment is something like 30 or 40 to 1. Not bad for any kind of investment. I've been concentrating here on a specific kind of question having to do with solar panels and wind turbines, but I think of this in broader terms, especially in these days of alternative facts and the confusion of voices promoting skepticism of any form of expert knowledge. It's not that we should always blindly follow experts. However, there are many intelligent people who spend a great deal of time honestly thinking about how to analyze and solve problems. Critical thinking is important, but so is the ability to recognize when others may have deeper experience and knowledge than we do on some issues. For WYSO, this is Bob Brekka.
Bob Brekka is a professor of physics and renewable and clean energy at the University of Dayton. He is research director of UD's Hanley Sustainability Institute and tweets at Bob Brekka. For more stories and commentaries, visit our website, wyso.org.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the sixth week of middle summer, the second week of the Blackberry Moon. Crows are usually silent during their mating time and the time they raise their young. Now their fledglings are almost grown and the crows come back together in flocks, and they begin to converse near my house before sunrise. The singing of robins and cardinals graces the spring and early summer, but as middle summer warms, the songs of those birds grow quiet. The crows, though, are the most faithful morning sky talkers throughout the late summer, fall, and winter. Sometimes I feel like answering them. Feel like cawing to join their society. My voice, though, lacks their clarity, and I'm hesitant to respond out loud to their calls. Now, some Trappist contemplatives with whom I'm acquainted emphasize waiting in prayer. Their practice of Lectio Divina, which is meditative reading of sacred texts, invites inspiration, insight, and communion. The one who practices lectio quiets his or her ego and voice and listens for the voice of God. Now, if crows were God, and if I wished communion, and if I wanted to use the lectio technique, then I would have to practice listening. I would read the seasons and then wait in silence. I would have to open my mind and leave ego and science and religion behind. I would have to let the message of the crows in my answer take their own form. Zen Master Dogen once noted that mind is no other than mountains and rivers and the great wide earth, the sun and the moon and the stars. Well, perhaps the mind is no other than crows, and communion not so difficult after all. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the first week of late summer. In the meantime, you might listen for crows.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at wyso.org.
That's it for this edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. I'm Jerry Kenney. We'll be back next Sunday morning at 10. Coming up next on WISO, it's Vic McCunis with The Book Nook.